Welcome to episode 112 of season 11 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we curry our way through the 2001 HBO award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again after a slight hiatus is Matthew Simpson of Northern Reel. Welcome back once again, Matthew.
Once again, thank you for having me. It is excellent to be here.
Yes, it is great having you back. Episode 112 begins with Spears querying a naked Chadwick and ends with Nixon briefing the troops. So we left things off yesterday with Chadwick in the middle of having a little fun with a local, and he gets interrupted by someone calling out to him, and we find out it's Spears. So this 5 minute segment begins with Chadwick, who I'm sure you can recognize who it is right away, right?
It's a very young and naked Tom Hardy.
That is right. A very, very young and naked Tom Hardy. Very good.
Back when he was still a skinny kid, too, because famously bulked up a few years after this. So he looks so young and fresh faced.
That's right. And, you know, well, he bulked up. Actually, can't even say that he bulked up. That would be another. I was going to say he bulked up to play Bane, but no, that's that's still 11 years away. So he must have bulked up before then for some other roles.
I mean, the thing he bulked up for
is Bronson.
Although it is still a few years later, but probably Bronson.
Yeah.
Rock and Roller was the same year, and probably something in between there. But yeah, Bronson and Rock and Roller that year were in 2008, probably the two.
Right. Well, again, that's still 7 years away from they are here. So.
Yeah.
An interesting way to do that. But
it's funny because I have distinct memories of him. Sorry, I'm derailing us a little bit. But distinct memories of him, I think it's the following year he plays the bad guy in Star Trek Nemesis, which is not the best Star Trek movie, but
Star Trek
Nemesis? Everyone's been in Star Trek, man.
That's right. It was 2002, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he was pretty good in that, but I always, first of all, it wasn't one of the best of the Star Trek movies, but
no,
on the other hand, it's just hard to believe that he's supposed to be a clone Picard. That's the thing that always got me.
Yeah, I mean, he was the young, up and coming, talented actor at the time, so it works. It works for me. But yeah, he definitely came into his own a few years later.
Yeah, for sure. Now everyone can look at that and say, "Oh wow, okay, we believe that this was a stepping stone for him."
Mm-hmm.
You know, you
I mean,
you,
like we
you get to have
like
sex
I said with, last week.
You know, you get to have sex with this German girl and stand and salute.
Well, and like I said, last week too. Like this series served as either an early or in this case, I think first project for so many young actors that have since been catapulted to fame. It's kind of a joy to watch because of that, but also just to know that they got launched by such a great project.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I remember, I think it was Lee Colley told me this, you know, when he was on about the fact that just about anybody who was anybody in, there was a book of up and coming British stars at the time, and all of them got these small little parts.
And, yeah, I mean, not to spoil it, but we're moments away from seeing a young Michael Fassbender as well.
That's right. That's right. Well, it won't be the first time we see Fassbender, so that's fine also. You know, it's not a spoiler.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. So, Janovich stands there, salutes, and the German girl has time to cover herself up. And Spears just comes into the room, doesn't flinch at all with the fact that there's a semi-naked woman there and a completely naked Janovich there. And he just turns to Janovich and goes, "Where's my stuff?" And he points to stuff on the side there and goes, "I thought I'd leave it over there, sir." And Spears just grabs the stuff and just walks out. And the German girl just starts laughing.
I mean, they both do because it's inherently quite funny.
It's a great segue. And the fact that Spears doesn't care for one second what Janovich is doing right now, as far as he's concerned, I just want my silver, and that's it.
Yeah.
Hi ho silver, as Sobel would have said. And he just like leaves the room. But the funniest part about it is he also just leaves the door open. He doesn't have a hand to close the door. So, he's more like, okay, well, that's your problem, not mine. And then we see Spears leave this building and starts walking through the town and nearly gets hit by a Jeep that's going by. And he backpedals for just a fraction of a second before he gets run over by this Jeep. And then we can tell that Nixon is actually in the Jeep, and Nixon goes over there, and they reach one of the buildings and he goes, "Here." And the driver continues to keep honking at people who are in the way. And then Nixon just gets out and he goes, "Thanks." He goes, "You're welcome, sir." And Nixon just then decides to go inside this building. But I mean, one of the things I also love is when we see him riding in the Jeep, he looks back and sees Spears and gives a pretty stern look at Spears. Even though, it makes you wonder, is he concerned about the fact that he sees that Spears has a bunch of is holding like silver, or is it just the fact that as we're going to find out shortly, why Nixon is a little perturbed? Which do you think it is?
I mean, I think it's probably both. Although Nixon has been, looking for and taking many, many bottles of his drink of choice, so I don't think he's one to necessarily comment on someone who might be, engaging in a little light looting. So I think probably Nixon's just like, this is another great episode being with Nixon being the focal point where he's just not in a good place the whole episode. So I think he's just not necessarily looking at Spears in particular with any like specific disdain, so much as he's just like in disdain for everything at the moment,
That's fair. Nixon enters the building, and right after him, Spears basically gets there also. And two of the soldiers that are walking out of the building sort of bump into Spears along the way. And "Oh, sir, morning, sir." And Spears just says, "Morning." And he walks over to the guy behind the desk, and you can tell that this is I guess you can sort of call it the local post office, I guess, for them. There's no other way of really describing what it is of where they are.
I mean, I think it's exactly what it is. I think it is even a post
No,
office,
but
isn't it? Like,
well, isn't it I mean, it's an allied post office. Meaning they just commandeered the post office, is that what you're saying?
yeah, like, isn't it just like a local post office they've commandeered?
Again, it's very possible. And now, did you notice that on the wall, on the left-hand wall, when Spears enters the room, you see an advertisement there?
I didn't.
Okay, so there's an advertisement for something called Opecta, which was a German company that sold what are known as pectin-based gelling agents for homemade jam. And what's really interesting is that this company was run in Amsterdam by Otto Frank, the father of Anne Frank.
Oh, well, that's
And
interesting.
the offices is the house where the Frank family hid during World War II.
Like actually, like the actual house.
The actual house. So the company at the time helped households make jam easily and cheaply because they had a product that required less sugar, which was ideal during during wartime when there were shortages. Basically, Otto Frank moved to Amsterdam in 1933 in order to establish and open up an office in a Dutch branch of Opekta. And Miep Guys, I think that's how you pronounce her name. She, she's one of the people who hid the Frank family. She was the secretary for the company,
Huh.
and the company, continued, and it thrived. I mean, it only closed down in 1995, if you can think about it. I mean, that's how long this company was around. So, again,
Well, it looks like it didn't actually close. It looks like it just got acquired, actually. So technically,
right.
it's actually technically still around because Dr. Oetker just bought it.
Fine. I meant as the name of Opecta. That was the, but again, I just think that's just really cool that you just see that on the wall and that's it. That doesn't, they have an advertisement for jam in the post office. Most post offices, at least in America, most post offices just have pictures of wanted criminals. I mean, here you have
That's true.
pictures of jam.
I imagine it was a much more 40s thing to do, especially this time of the 40s, to have advertisement for staple goods and or staple good replacements,
That's right.
probably more common than it would be any decade after that, for sure.
Probably true. But again, I just like that little tidbit you can find there.
No, I mean it's I love little details like that. I hadn't noticed that before, so thank you for bringing it up for me.
You're very welcome. So you see, that's the thing. Once you bring these things up and you rewatch, you'll notice these things, which is great. I love doing it. I love finding those little things. And he starts having Spear starts having a conversation with Vest. Spear goes, a box all this stuff will fit into? And he goes, I think so. Same destination? And he goes, yeah. And he goes, yes, sir. I'll make sure it goes out first thing in the morning. He goes, thank you, Private. And this soldier then looks at Spears and goes, your folks are sure gonna have quite a collection by the time you get. And Spears just ignores him and starts walking out and he goes, home, sir. And Spears just turns to him and goes, "Finders keepers." So this is a very interesting way to, to look at things. That someone like Spears, is, taking things that are quite valuable, I guess you can say, at that point. And I also like the little point where he takes out two packs of cigarettes and puts them, on the silver platter in order for Vest to just take them, meaning he's more or less bribing the guy that this is what he needs to do.
Yeah, I mean, because what he's doing is again, we said last time, he's engaged in some light looting, so probably needs to grease the wheels to make sure it happens without getting caught by whatever oversight might be in
And but
place.
again, he still knows what he's doing and how he's going to get it done. That type of thing. We
Yeah,
can
for sure.
hear by the way that this conversation goes, this isn't the first time that he's here.
No, I think isn't there a moment too, like isn't he the one who earlier in the series he like saves his parachute to send home because it's made out of silk?
No. That was Harry. Harry Welsh saves that in order to use it as maybe a wedding gown
Oh,
for
right. I didn't rewatch the earlier episodes for this. I just rewatched the two that we're talking about, so couldn't remember that detail.
That's fine. Spears knows that this stuff is going to be going where it should be going. And it shows also a lot of Spears' personality. The fact that we do see him, as you said, doing this late looting, meaning it doesn't bother him. He says, okay, these people started a war against us, and whatever I find, I get to keep. And I wonder how true that might be to real life.
I'm sure it happened. I'm sure that, spoils of war are a thing, no matter how much, the brass might try to limit it. Like, it's gonna happen.
Yes, no, I completely agree. My point is I wonder if it's is it Spears who was looting or not? That's the question that I'm curious about.
Yeah, that I couldn't tell you.
That's the thing. Did they mention anything about Spears being the one who loots or not? That's what I'm curious about. Because it is possible that it is him, and it's possible that it's not. No, actually, they do mention it in the book. Yeah, they talk about it. It says Spears would finally show up, and you wouldn't see Spears for about 2 or 3 hours. He was the worst looter I ever saw. He couldn't sleep at night thinking there was a necklace or something around. Whenever he got a chance, Spears would mail his loot back to his wife in England. He needed the money it would bring. His wife had just had a baby. And it also mentions here that as far as Spears was concerned, they could take whatever they wanted. They would go place to place and get whatever they could. And so I mean they do mention it in a later episode, the fact that he is sending all this stuff to his wife. And just wait until they get to the Eagle's Nest. At that point we're gonna see even more. But yeah. Spears was a major looter. But we'll talk more about that when we get to the end and talk about what happened to different people about Spear what actually happened with all the stuff that Spears sent to his wife at the time. We'll get there. But yeah, Spears is having fun here. That's the bottom line. And he just leaves the post office, and then we see someone pouring a bottle of that. Then we see Nixon is just taking drink after drink after drink, and we know that the vats are his. And he's just had enough. And then he goes and starts washing his face, in a little basin there. And then we hear a knock on the door, and it's Winters. And Winters goes, "Nix, Nix," goes in here, looks at him, and goes, "Dog, making combat jump for the 17th while I'm in supply briefings all morning. Yeah, lucky me. Well, congratulations. You're probably the only man on the 101st with 3 combat stars over his jump wings." So, I mean, it's a very interesting comment for Winters to make, because as we were talking about last week when you were on, Winters wants to be in the fray with everyone else, and in some ways he's very jealous of Nixon, that Nixon is able to have these this third jump. But what's even more interesting is they don't even tell us in the movie where he jumped. They just say that he jumped in with jumped the 17th. Which is also very interesting, from the way that they bring that up. And obviously
I mean,
he's not very happy with it.
he's not very happy. I also don't think it really matters, right? Like, it's not so much where or I think they tell us why, but it doesn't really matter because, like, the focus is more that, like, he's so done, right?
Oh, correct, for sure. But what matters to me is I'm trying to place, where they are at this point, where there is a third combat jump. That's the way I'm looking at it.
Okay.
I'm not looking at it like for the story, the way that they're telling it here, it doesn't make a difference. That I understand. The way, what they're trying to show us here with Nixon, how he's completely distraught about this whole thing, has it really doesn't matter where he jumped. But again, I'm talking about it from the perspective of listening to the story and saying, okay, well, we know they jumped in Normandy, they jumped in Market Garden, and where are they jumping now? That's my that's the question that I ask here.
Yeah, fair enough.
We see how distraught Nixon is at this point, and Nixon turns to Winters and goes, "Well, not bad for somebody who's never fired his weapon in combat, huh?" Winters looks at him and goes, "Really?" He goes, "Really? You've never?" He goes, "Nope." And he goes, "And not even with all the action we've seen? Not around." And he pours himself more booze. "So, how'd it go this morning? The jump? It was great. Fantastic. We took the direct hit over the drop zones. I got out. Two others got out. Winters looks at him and goes, and the rest of the boys? Well, they blew up over Germany somewhere. Boom. Yeah. I'm sorry. It was about what? Well, tough situation for the... Oh, yeah. The boys. Yeah. It's terrible. Oh, well. Wasn't me. You know, the real tragedy is they also lost their CO. So guess who gets to write all the letters home? Goddamn nightmare. And, again, they're showing us how, just the difficulty of this whole thing for someone like Nixon, who, we've known since the first part in the series, he's always been drinking. And now we see that he's doing all he can to make sure that he's able to forget what they did, what he needed to do. And I looked it up in the book, and the book actually mentions where he did his jump. So on page 203 of the book, it mentions it. It says, one 506 man who was not left behind was Captain Nixon. General Taylor selected him to jump with the 17th as an observer for the 101st. Fortunately for Nixon, he was assigned to be jump master of his plane. The plane was hit. Only Nixon and three others made it out before it crashed. Nixon was attached to the 17th for only one night. On March 25th, he was sent back over the Rhine and flown by a special small plane back to the 2nd Battalion in Mormelin. The jump qualified Nixon to be one of two men in the 506th eligible to wear three stars on his jump wings: Normandy, Holland, and Operation Varsity. The other was Sergeant Wright of the Pathfinders, who had been in easy company back at Tekoa. German resistance to Operation Varsity was fierce. Meanwhile, infantry and armored divisions of the U.S. First Army were pouring across the Rhine via the recently captured Ludendorff Bridge at Remagen, then swinging north to encircle the German army defending Germany's industrial heartland in a roar. So, again, it's something that's just mentioned here, but it works really well, the way that they do this whole thing. By showing how much something like this affects someone like Nixon. And again, as I just read, there's only two people in the entire 506 that had three that are three combat jumps. So just crazy. I mean, again, the main reason why they stopped having combat jumps in battle is because they're really dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they're this is a great and effective way to show how tough battle can sometimes be, even on someone like Nixon, who has been around for all the whole time, but we're only now finding out that he's never shot his gun. Then he starts looking around for another bottle, trying to keep getting more drunk. And Winters then says to him, well, I got a visit from Colonel Sink this morning. He goes, mm-hmm. He goes, and how is the good colonel? He goes, concerned. And he goes, still drinking nothing but the Vet 69, huh? Nixon goes, only the finest for Mrs. Nixon's baby boy. He starts laughing. And Winters says to him, is that a problem up at regiment? What, this? Is that what he said? No, I just don't like it up there. Good. You'll be happy to hear the Sink is transferring you back down to Battalion S3. And Nixon just gives him a little bit of a look, because again, he's being demoted because everyone sees that he's not able to take things in the right way and is boozing a little too much, I guess you could say.
I mean, you don't have to guess. That's pretty much exactly what's going on, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But Nixon, he doesn't seem too fazed or upset about the fact that that's what's being done. It's more matter of fact and, okay, this is what my actions have done, so that's fine. But, I think Winters in some ways is happy that he's still going to be around, that he's moving back to being with them, as opposed to, maybe because then he can keep a little more of an eye on him. To keep his friend in check, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I mean, I think Nixon is, he's pretty troubled through, especially through this part, the latter part of the war. He's seen sort of too much. He's drinking too much. It's a pretty standard case of, I guess what they would call not shell shock, but like certainly like PTSD. His mental health has taken a turn for the worse after everything he's seen and done and
Exactly.
or not done.
Correct. And then Nixon also then just changes the subject right away. And he goes, so what do you think I should write to these parents, Dick? And Winters just looks at him sternly and goes, did you hear what I said, Nix? You've been demoted. And Nix just looks at him and goes, yeah, demoted, gotcha. Because I don't know how to tell them their kids never even made it out of the goddamn plane. And he goes, you tell them what you always tell them. Their sons died as heroes. Nixon looks at him and goes, you really be still believe that? And he goes, yeah, I do. Don't you? He goes, ha. And, at this point, first of all, this is a great conversation between these two characters. Because we can see that Nixon is getting disillusioned by things, but Winters is doing all he can to try and help him and keep him at least as focused as possible, which is great. I like the way that they do that. They have this this heart to heart, which is very important for both of them in order to move their stories forward and their friendship forward also. Which is great.
It's also just a really believable conversation between, two friends who obviously care for one another, and one who's going through something, the other one trying to like, wake him up to what he's going through a little bit, wake him up to the fact that he's sort of maybe taking things too far, in that sort of like 40s manly way, I think it's a great and relatable interaction.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And one of the things I also like here is the contrast with the conversation that the two of them had back in part five, where Nixon was basically telling Winters that he doesn't know how to write reports properly, he's taking too much time, and that you just have to be as succinct as possible with what you're saying. And now Winters is basically giving him that same advice back. Sorry, I like that.
No, I think the whole thing works really, really well. And it's one of those things that can only really be, achieved in a long form story like this,
Yeah,
where
for
they have
sure.
so much depth. It's one of the great advantages of being a mini series or a TV series that, the characters have so much depth and history that they can say these things without requiring a lot more context. In the best way.
Yeah, for sure. No, I love the way that they do that. So it works really well with what they're doing there. And then the shot changes and we see the men all outside. We see some soldiers that are playing cards, and we can hear that Nixon is briefing the men, briefing as many of them as possible with everything that's going on. And then so we hear Nixon say the Cooperative for American Remittance to Europe, or CARE, has been assembling food packages stateside to assist those European families in dire need. So it's great how we have Winters and Nixon having this conversation, and then immediately afterwards we see the type of work that Nixon has been demoted back to doing. Basically, in some ways he feels like a cruise director, the way that he's doing this stuff. So I like the way that they show that
Yeah, I
dynamic.
mean, I think it all plays into just how over it all he is, like he's clearly just like, I think it's made clearer toward the end of the episode, but like this is a pretty pivotal episode. We're not going to get into I think the real meat of it with these two segments, but the length and depth of the things he's seen and has really gotten to him. And I think that all of this preamble really hammers home that he's just sort of shut down. It's really, really well performed by Livingston. I think I've always liked him. I liked him before this. I've liked him since, but I think one of my favorite performances of his. This not just this whole series, but like this episode in particular.
Yeah, I completely agree. I love the way that they do this. And again, it works so well in framing things for us, which is what we need.
Yeah, 100%.
And in mid-sentence, Nixon gets cut off, and that's how our segment will end. So is there anything else you wanted to add about this particular segment?
No, I think we pretty much covered it.
Okay, perfect. Today we will be playing a game of World War II movie trivia. So I'm going to give you five trivia questions, random trivia questions, and we'll see how well you know your World War II movie trivia. So let's
Sounds good.
spin the wheel and see what we get. And I'll give you a hint there. The questions are very heavy on Saving Private Ryan and The Great Escape, if that helps at all.
I mean, it might. It'll definitely 50% help.
Maybe, but your first question is not from that. So unfortunately, that won't help you. Not from either of those.
Right, we're ready when you are.
Okay, so this. Okay, there is a movie from 1951, okay, about Marines, and the title of this movie is based on part of the famous Marine ballad. So do you have any idea what that could be? Are you familiar with the Marine ballad? Again, I can't say that I can't start singing it for you because that'll give things away.
The Marine ballad is the Halls of Montezuma to the Shores of Tripoli, right?
That's right, correct.
So I don't know what m movie you're talking about, but I assume it is something to do with those first two lines.
And you would be correct.
So is it Montezuma or is it Tripoli?
it's known as the Halls of Montezuma.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, it's a it's it was actually a very interesting movie with Richard Widmark and Jack Palance. I enjoyed it a lot. But yes, it's all about a bunch of Marines trying to blow up a Japanese rocket base. And it's called the
Nice.
Halls of Montezuma. Right.
I will add it to my list.
It's been a while since I've seen it. I probably should rewatch it one of these days also, but I liked it. Right, so let's go to your next trivia question. Round and round and round the wheel goes. Let's see what question you're going to get. The 1981 movie The Bunker was nominated for three Emmys. How many Emmys do you think it won of those three, if any?
Are you able to tell me what the categories were?
It was nominated for outstanding film sound mixing, outstanding supporting actress, and outstanding lead actor.
One. I'm gonna guess one.
Okay, and which of those three do you think it is?
Supporting actress.
Nope, sorry. I
I
guess
mean, was it sound mixing then?
again.
Oh.
No.
So like Anthony Hopkins actually
So
won. Interesting.
Anthony Hopkins won, yes. Anthony Hopkins has an Emmy for playing
Huh.
Hitler.
I wonder how close he is to an EGOT, actually.
I don't think is he known for things on the stage?
I mean, I think he is. I'm just not sure about not sure about American stage.
Okay, that's true.
Like I know he has an Olivier. I don't know if he has a Tony.
Okay, well, he let's put it this way: for he actually has won two Emmys in his career. He was nominated six times, and he won the first two times that he was nominated in 1976 for the for playing Bruno Richard Hoffman in the Lindbergh kidnapping case, and then he won for The Bunker, and then he did not win for playing Quasimodo in The Hunchback of Notre Dame, The Hunchback of Notre Dame from 82, in playing Magwitch in The Great Expectations in 1990, playing Dr. Robert Ford in Westward in 2017, and for playing for being the narrator of the TV show Mythic Quest in 2021.
All of which are excellent. I mean, I haven't, to be fair, I haven't seen Hunchback, but Great Expectations, Westworld, and Mythic Quest, his performances are all great.
I'm actually curious to see him in the Lindbergh kidnapping case. That sounds actually very interesting
I
also.
haven't seen that one either, but
I'm just familiar with I think Stephen Rabe played him in like an HBO miniseries, HBO movie about it. I'm trying to remember the name of it, okay, so let's spin the wheel again and see what your next question will be. So round and round and round the wheel goes. Okay, who plays the main character in named Private John Reese in the 1962 World War II film Hell Is for Heroes?
I've never seen that movie, so I don't know the answer.
I'm trying to think of how to give you a hint without giving it away completely. Okay, he would go on to play a very iconic character just 1 year later in a movie that I told you that there will be a lot of questions about.
Oh,
The
that
1963.
means that it's Steve McQueen.
Yes, it is. Very
Yeah.
good. Nicely done. He's much more memorable as Hills. No question about that.
I mean, again, I haven't seen Hell's for Heroes, so I think the earliest film of Steve McQueen's that I've seen is The Blob, in which he plays the oldest 17-year-old in recorded history.
Okay. All right. So your next question. Okay, this is from a movie in 1956 called Reach for the Sky. Okay, and it's a biopic about the RAF Captain Douglas Bader. Okay, who after being injured flew a British fighter plane during World War II. So the question that I have for you is what limb or limbs was he missing that he was still able to fly a plane?
That's a great question, but if he's still able to fly, I'm gonna
That's
guess
right. He had
legs.
lost both legs.
'Cause I know there's pedals for stuff in planes, but I think that the stick is probably more important.
It's true. So yeah, it's a movie that came out in 1956. It was actually written by Paul Brickhill, who wrote The Great Escape, a book called The Story of Douglas Bader. And Douglas Bader was played by Kenneth Moore in this film. Again, it was an interesting movie. Again, showing how someone injured like this is able to overcome their injuries and make it back and still be able to fly a plane. Very interesting. Okay, so let's spin the wheel for your final trivia question today. Round and round and round the wheel goes. You ever see the movie Attack with Jack Palance?
Nope.
All right, so you're probably not going to know the answer to this question because the answer will not be Jack Palance. But in the movie Attack from 1956, who played the cowardly officer that got his job via nepotism?
So I've never seen the movie, so I don't know. I would
Okay,
like a hint, please.
let's give you a few options, I guess you can say. Okay, I'm debating, should I use names of people who are in the movie or people who are not in the movie? No, you know what? I'm going to give you a list of five actors that are in this movie, and it will be one of them. And it's not Jack Palance, obviously. All right.
Okay.
So, all right. Is it Lee Marvin, Robert Strauss, Richard Jackal, Eddie Albert, or Buddy Ebsen?
And the
Okay. Now,
character's like a sniveling coward type thing.
yes. He's a sibling coward. Now, I mean, you obviously you know who all five of those actors are who I mentioned, right?
Yes. I'm just not gonna lie, I'm just Googling to make sure I recognize their faces.
Okay. Well, I can just give you, I can remind you. Lee Marvin was in The Dirty Dozen. Robert Strauss was in Solid 17. Richard Jackal was also in The Dirty Dozen. Buddy Ebsen is from The Beverly Hillbillies, and Eddie Albert is from Green Acres. I
Yes.
don't know if that helps you.
It does partially. So it's not Jack Palance. So again, I've never seen this movie. So this is a guess. I'm gonna guess that it is not Lee Marvin.
Okay, you've now lowered it down to four choices. Good.
I guess I have like a 25% chance. I'm gonna guess Eddie Albert.
And you would be correct.
Nice.
And I gotta say he's great in this movie. I'm a big fan of the movie Attack. I think it's amazing, especially knowing Band of Brothers so well and seeing. I mean, it's pretty much the battle of the attack on Foy, and it reminds me a lot of Dyke and all that stuff that's going on there and stuff like that. So I think they do a great job with that. And again, this is a movie that came out in '56, so many many years before came to know Easy Company. So, and Jack Palance plays the commander of the soldiers who basically gets very upset at Eddie Albert's character because he's a commander who doesn't know what he's doing, which again sounds a little familiar with what we're dealing with here.
A little bit,
All right, so now we will play the daily game of Name That World War II Movie, and it is possible that you will get a question that is of something that we just talked about. You never know, because it is completely random. So let's spin the wheel and see what question Matthew gets today. Okay. This is a movie from 1981, and Anthony Hopkins plays Hitler.
Okay, so it's the bunker.
Right, you see, you have a good memory.
I mean that's
That's
just a stroke of luck for me, I think. That's amazing.
well, these things happen. It's that is why I do this completely random, so that these things can happen. Not in order to help, but just because that's just the way it is. There are random things that happen in life, and getting the same question in two different games, or the same answer from the same question in two different games is pretty good. Nicely done. All right, so Matthew, would you like to tell everyone where they can find you?
Yeah, the there's two great ways to find me. One is my personal portfolio site, which is stretched.ca. You can find links to all or at least most of my freelance work there. And then the other great way right now is my new publication, Northern Reel, which is a website dedicated to the cinema and talent of Canada, in which we're doing film reviews and interviews, and we have all kinds of plans for retrospectives and history and all kinds of other stuff upcoming. So it's as of this taping, it is only a month or so old, so it's still early days, but it's been very exciting and very rewarding to do, and I hope you guys check it out and hope you like it.
Very cool. All right, and finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. If you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@moviearound.net. So, Matthew, do you feel like coming back again tomorrow to test out your World War II movie knowledge and talk more about Band of Brothers?
I mean, absolutely, I do. I have to redeem myself, although I'm gonna not gonna lie, I probably won't with the trivia. But
Well, there won't be any more trivia tomorrow, so you don't have to worry about it from that perspective.
okay, well, that's good. Because I feel like I did really bad. But yes, I'm happy to come back at least one more time.
No, why would you say you did so bad? You didn't do so terrible. You know, considering the fact that you hadn't seen any of these movies,
Yeah,
it
fair
wouldn't be so
enough.
bad. So yeah, that's fine. That's fine. All right. So until tomorrow, Curry.
Curry.